really nice to be here today. And I haven't seen the new space, so it's a real treat to see that you found yourselves a real home, some place to dig in deep. And as Rob mentioned, I've been sort of peripherally and sometimes not so peripherally connected over the several decades now. And it just, it's always a great joy to reconnect with the Clouds and Water community. And I have found in many ways that hearing and seeing what you folks have been doing over all these years has really helped Common Ground to evolve. And I have a few things I want to ask Sozan about before I leave today. So it's I just to have a lot of gratitude and respect for the, especially the quality of community that Clouds and Water has manifested over the years, and the way that the community has worked together. And the kind of container that you've created for your practice here. So I'm really happy to be part of that and to share a few teachings this morning. And although I came up with the title for the talk back in July, I think it's it didn't occur to me that it would be right after the election. And so the topic today is wholehearted engagement without attachment. And as you, I'm sure, sense, it's really all about really the essence of our practice. There's, I think, an important shadow to name in our practice, this idea, and it's everywhere in our culture, and I think just generally in spiritual practice, this idea of get me the heck out of here. So we see the world, we see the messiness, we sense our own personality, we see the insufficiency of our personality, and you know, our habits of fear, our habits of judging, and that critical mind, that being a victim, feeling helpless, feeling not good enough, shame. We see so many things in us, in our hearts, in our minds, around us in the world. And part of what can masquerade for spiritual practice is that, get me the heck out of here. So I want to transcend the messiness. And the reason it's a good shadow is because there are elements of the path that allow for that freedom, that feeling unstained, not pushed around by the messiness in the world, not oppressed by what's going on. We even get a little of that just coming into the serene space of Clouds and Water, the Zendo, right? And you hear the purity of the sound of the bell at the beginning of the sit, and everybody knows the routine, and we feel like in this collection of human beings that we can sit still in a relaxed way and feel safe, feel at home. So there are important parts of the practice, the sesshins, the retreats, the daily sitting, the community forms that we use that create a sense of transcendence, a little bit of space, a little bit of freedom from messiness, from confusion, from uncertainty, from life not unfolding the way we thought it was supposed to unfold, or whatever you might, you know, whatever might be provoking that sort of existential, no, this cannot be, this is not okay. Could be a job loss, relationship ending, presidential election, so many things that seemingly pull the rug out. And so our first instinct is like, crawl into bed, go to the Zendo, have a sit. Those are relatively good instincts. But how about an instinct, how about a practice that leans in, that opens up? Some of you, I'm assuming maybe many of you know Reb Anderson. One of the reasons I used to come to Clouds and Water for many years during his annual sesshin, or retreat or just teaching here at Clouds and the other Zen centers in town, I'd come and listen and be part of those. And recently, not that long ago, I read something he had written, and I thought it was a really useful line, especially at these times. And he said something like, you know the difference between an ordinary human being and somebody who has practiced well? An ordinary human being is vulnerable some of the time, and a well-practiced human being is vulnerable all of the time. And I think that's a nice kind of intro into the subject of wholehearted engagement, free from attachment. It's instead of pathologizing what we sometimes feel when we sit down, before we've transcended, you know, in Vipassana practice, you know, we talk about working with the hindrances, whatever it is that hinders, that interrupts, that masks the basic emptiness, the basic space, the basic love and freedom of the mind, of the heart. So before we do our Dharma moves and get into that nice space, right, we're invited. I think it's an important invitation. Before we even need to do all the Dharma moves, I think it's important to look at what is our relationship with the experience of vulnerability, with the yucky feeling we might have in the body, in the heart, the restlessness, the judgment, or whatever might initially present itself when we sit down, compose ourselves, and then just feel what we feel in the most ordinary and directive ways. Doesn't that feel, even on the surface, like a relief not to have to run? Not to have to be a different human being, not to have to have a different existence. Isn't that what real freedom points to, our intuition, right? The kind of freedom our heart intuits is possible. Isn't it a freedom that doesn't require that we fix something or we get rid of something? And it really, that opening or just bringing that frame to mind, it really challenges our notions of monsters and bad guys, evildoers. What's scary? What is the proper relationship with what we see as scary in our life? Whether it's dementia or financial ruin or being alone or being part of a wider society or wider world that is expressing a lot of ignorance around racial justice, around economic justice, around climate change, around whatever it might be. What do we do with those monsters? And it's just so easy to imagine that throwing it out of our heart or reinforcing this dualistic sense, there's the wise, the good, the pure, and there's the impure and the bad and the evil. Because we get, there's some juice there immediately. That's sort of the juiciness of self-righteousness, and it reinforces the sense of a me who's not that, who's afraid of that, who feels oppressed by that. I'm not saying this work is easy. It's not easy. And it's totally understandable that we'd want to close down, that we'd want to retreat. We'd want to get to that quiet place. And so this is really our practice, this stance. You know, I was just writing an article yesterday for a publication, I was talking about how You know, just the importance of that contrast, having put down my fear, having found a place where my mind isn't being pushed around by my fear and my hate and my judgment, right? Then I can see it clearly for what it is. So when I'm getting pushed around by my fear, my hate, my greed, it's really hard for me to see it for what it is. Because the clarity of the mind is distorted. The view in the mind is that fear is real as it presents itself, like the conceptual, the story about it is true. So we need our practice, and we need our form, and we need our communities, we need our sesshins, because initially for most of us, equanimity and that empty space of love and wisdom, that's first realized not because we're actually wise, but because the form and the practice and the particular present moment circumstances have supported enough safety that the mind puts down its primal fear and its primal greed, because the moment has enough elements that make the heart go, ah, I can be here. And so we taste an equanimity that in our tradition, we talk about the equanimity that comes from seclusion. We have secluded the mind, the heart, from what provokes it, right? It's like when you come here. I'm sure there are people in the community that provoke you, but probably fewer than at work or maybe even at home. Yeah, and besides, you're not really looking around, and you've got that little sound machine that you can't even get irritated by people's movements because that sort of blocks the sound, and it's nice. I notice I could hardly hear any traffic in the room. It's sort of checking out the space here, your new space. It's really quiet. And so that seclusion, the mind goes, this feels pretty safe. And as things get quieter, we feel, the mind feels, senses, the heart senses how much it's holding in it. It just puts things down to some degree. And the more we practice, the more skillful the mind is at putting things down. And we touch samadhi, this stability of mind, this unity of mind, collectedness of mind. And we get a taste of equanimity. It's not freedom, but it's a taste of freedom. So then the question is, what is this kind of equanimity, this heart not being tormented because it's retreated, it's secluded from what torments it? How would this non-tormented heart, what could it look like as I move back into the world, the messy world, the imperfect world, where I have to interact with other human beings, I have to make choices, I have to, you know, engage what seems to me the meanness of the world, or engage my own meanness, my own, you know, just the pettiness of our own mind. One of the great things about intimate relationships, right, is that we see how petty our minds can be. If you haven't seen it, either you're fully awake or you're not paying attention. There's another one of these shadows where we somehow, the mind assumes that it's better to pretend it ain't so than to honestly acknowledge the kind of pettiness, meanness, greediness, fear, critical, judging qualities that all the time express themselves. So what is equanimity? What does engagement look like? How to be in the world without being afraid of it? and sort of express this truth that's some of you know about Kuan Yin. I thought you used to have a Kuan Yin here. Oh, yeah. But in the Mahayana tradition, first in Avalokiteshvara in India and Tibet, but then as it moved into China, it became this feminine symbol, Kuan Yin, sort of the one who listens to the cries of the world and responds in beautiful ways. And one teaching that's sort of attributed to this archetype of compassion and wisdom is the winds of circumstance, right? All that comes and goes in our life, the winds of circumstance blow through emptiness. Whom can they harm? So this is the equanimity that can go into the world, but not being pushed around, not being confused by the joys and the sorrows, the good and the bad. And so this is what, in a sense, this is what we're being asked in our practice, how to do this. Some of you know Rodney Smith, who's a longtime teacher in this tradition at IMS, and he's been one of the main teachers in Seattle in the insight meditation community there. He wrote this article, I saw it in Tricycle a ways back, Undivided Mind. He says in that, what obscures this understanding in many of us is the belief that the silent retreat is a priority over other expressions of life. When we believe we are not where we need to be for spiritual growth, we relegate our daily life to a secondary tier. We energetically pull out of our spiritual life and wait for the appropriate secluded moment in order to fully engage. Leaning toward or away from any experience creates an anticipation of fulfillment in the future, and the sacred that exists here and now is lost. Discovering the sacred within all moments is the hallmark of awakening. We often feel our everyday existence is a distraction from our spiritual intention. When this happens, life is divided between the sacred and the mundane, and the mind pits one concept against the other. But belief shapes reality, and if the belief is maintained that the sacred lies somewhere else other than now, our spiritual life will be governed by that limitation. And I really see this as the relevant edge in my own practice, is learning to see all the places where generally the thing that triggers the insight or the understanding is I catch the instinct of wanting to go back to my practice, wanting to rush back, both in my formal sit, like I'm sure you've noticed. You're sitting, you get lost in distraction, then the mind notices it, and then what do you notice that sort of neurotic, oh yeah, you like rush back to the posture, or rush back to the breath, or rush back to whatever the mind's idea of composure might be. You know, oh yeah, bad. Good. And as opposed to, I think what real wisdom does, real awakening does, when it sees that no good, bad, despicable, whatever, mind, heart, body, doing what it does, thinking about this, worrying about that, having a sexual fantasy or getting even with somebody or, you know, exactly what you think is, doesn't belong in this room especially. You know, what real wisdom awakening does, it understands that moment as nature. Oh yeah, sometimes it's like this. Right? Sometimes causes and conditions, the natural unfolding of all things, the interdependent unfolding of all things, sometimes it's like this. Yeah, is this scary? Right? That's what wisdom asks. Is it scary? Is there any need to construct a defense? To run away, to feel stained by what's going on. Do you notice when you listen to news or for whatever reason you run into somebody who has different political views, different social views than you, then it can feel that we need a defense, that somehow we'll be contaminated or we need a response. It doesn't really occur to us very often to like experiment with being undefended and intimate. Really intimate. Here's a little bit more Rodney Smith. This is a great article, Undivided Mind. You can get it online, I think. A little bit later in that article, he says, "We cannot delay fully embracing the moment. To do so maintains the divisions within the mind. The division between the mind and the body, and the division between the organism and its environment. All divisions are attempts to keep us from the truth of what is right here. When this is understood by the sincere practitioner, there can be no more hesitation, no more postponement, and no more pulling back and waiting for a more opportune time. It is literally now or never. Suddenly the Buddha is found in the middle of relationships, work and family, within all activities, reactions, thoughts, and emotional responses. Nothing is outside now, because no boundary is drawn to separate now from then. The message of the Buddha is equally relevant in all locations and at all times. Until this is fully realized, until there is no movement to escape this environment for a better spiritual setting, we will continue to suffer." So this is the real dynamic. There's a reason why people misunderstand the Buddhist teachings and think of it, and this is sort of a very common question. I'm sure the teachers here get this all the time, as we do. But there's some sense that the practice that the Buddha offered was about retreating. You know, we get into our quiet space and we just allow the world to unfold. But we've learned how to be retreated or secluded or in our own space. So people ask, like, what about the world? Doesn't it need our engagement? Well, the answer is obviously yes. And in fact, there is no non-engagement. There's no way to be a human being and not be engaged. You could sit at home in front of the TV on your couch with your potato chips or whatever it might be, your particular salty, crunchy food, and that's your engagement. I mean, you may not like that idea of engagement, but that can be just as much as an engagement as somebody, you know, running for political office or marching on the streets. So as long as we're alive, we're engaged. It's just a question of what our engagement is setting in motion. It's always about karma. What is our engagement setting in motion for ourselves and for all beings? That's really the question. There was an interesting interaction at the time of the Buddha between the Buddha and a general, and the general complained to the Buddha that the Dharma is mere passivity, right? This is what we always hear. What do you know? You know, all your teaching is about people being passive, shaving their heads, putting on robes, leaving behind their families, their jobs, their responsibility. And the Buddha replied, "I teach inactivity in regards to unwholesome things and to and activity by way of good conduct or wholesome things." Right? Don't do stupid things. To quote our previous, or still current leader, Barack Obama once said that and people didn't like it. Don't do stupid things. Don't put your energy in things that are unskillful, that lead to suffering for one and all. But do things that are wise and skillful, that come out of love and come out of a wisdom. So that's what we learn, you know, when we're sitting still, when we're on retreat, on sesshin, we're learning the difference between motivations, intentions, qualities of mind that are trustworthy, that are worthy of acting on, allowing nature to unfold, allowing nature to express itself, love, fearless love, fierce compassion to express itself. Right? And learning to restrain the forces in our heart and mind that don't seem so trustworthy. I don't think I'm going to say that. I'm not going to act that out. I feel the force of habit, but I'm not going to say that to my spouse. I'm not going to speak out the insecurity I have arising out of my conditioning as a white, straight male. You know, I feel it. I'm actually grateful that I see it, but I'm not going to act it out. I'm not going to speak it out because I realize its limitations. I realize I can, with our practice of paying attention in this balanced way, we can actually see directly how that voice, that force of habit, it's coming out of that fear place, that narrow. We can't get rid of our cultural conditioning, but we can learn to see it, which is such a liberating thing, to begin to see how all of us, each in our own way, have been conditioned by the place, the places, the people we've been conditioned by. It's nothing to be ashamed of. The real shame is somehow not being curious about it, I guess. But even that is understandable because it's hard work to be willing to do this work. And in a way, there's no, how could there be awakening? How could there be real freedom that depends on seclusion, depends on being in some proverbial cave or some proverbial cool progressive place or whatever your sort of equivalent of a cave, you know, this town with progressive people or this town with this place with like-minded people here at Clouds and Water. But how about, what is that awakening? What is that freedom, that ability to live out of wisdom and compassion? What does it look like in other places in our lives? Can we live out of wisdom and compassion? Can we live in a way that doesn't leave traces of suffering everywhere? That's the interesting question, isn't it? So this is the dance, I think, of all Dharma practitioners, where we study the Buddhist teachings and we understand and learn skillful ways of retreating, secluding the mind, and getting the flavor of equanimity, realizing that a collected mind that is temporarily free of craving, temporarily free of greed, anger, and delusion. Not because it's uprooted those habits in our mind, but because the conditions have allowed those not so helpful tendencies to retreat. They're just in the background because they're not getting provoked. Greed isn't getting provoked. Anger is not getting provoked. Dullness isn't getting provoked. Restlessness isn't getting provoked. Doubt isn't getting provoked. This is what the Buddha meant. This is the technical definition of samadhi, is when those five hindrances have retreated from the mind. Then we say the mind is in a collected, stable, clear space. And when that's developed to a large degree, then we say, this is like the fourth jhana for those who know these teachings, then greed has left the mind temporarily. And that's real equanimity. That's called a good sit, right? And then we might think, well, I've done it. And then you can spend the rest of your day being proud or arrogant, right? And making, you know, really stinking up the place and nobody really wanting to be around you. Or if wisdom continues to be active, or you could say, so now this equanimity, this peace, this clarity that arose because of seclusion, now let's see if the mind, the heart can realize an equanimity, a non-distortion, clarity, and a responsivity that will arise because of wisdom, not because of seclusion, right? So the wisdom that understands that whatever gets triggered, whatever habit gets triggered within my own heart, or whatever habit gets triggered in your heart, whatever you express, whatever I express, whatsoever I'm sensitive to as I move into the world, then with wisdom I see, well, that's just the nature of things. One of our teachers in this tradition, Sylvia Boorstein, wrote once that she realized, you know, in every moment that things, I forget exactly how the phrase goes, but breathtakingly can't be other than the way that they are, right? It's like, this is what wisdom reveals, you know, from that place of relative equanimity that we get because we've sat or we've been cultivating the continuity of mindful awareness in our life, this steady presence, then we begin to see the world differently, right? We see the interdependent, we see the impersonal nature, we see breathtakingly, it can't be other than what it is. Given everything that's in motion, can this moment right now be different than it is? No. So when we understand that, you see, then because it can't be different, the basic trigger for greed, anger, and delusion is abandoned, right? Because the trigger for greed, anger, and delusion is somehow thinking, this isn't right. The way it is right now isn't right. The way I am right now, what I'm feeling, what I'm seeing in you isn't right. So as an ordinary human being, not a wise human being, my thought is, I've got to make it right. I got to either fix you or fix me or get out of here. But with wisdom, we see the beauty. This is something you probably notice as you leave clouds and water after a good sesshin, a good sit. You look at the street and how the cars are parked and the boulevard and the trash in the street or the this and the that. But it all looks right, doesn't it? Right? Everything like... Because the mind is understanding. You may not recognize what's going on, but the mind understands the interdependent nature, like breathtakingly, it can't be other than the way it is right now. And then it's out of that understanding that we respond moment by moment by moment. But you'll notice right in that moment, in those moments, that the heart isn't afraid. The heart doesn't believe, doesn't need anger to help it figure out what to do next, doesn't need greed, because it already feels independent or self-sufficient or free. So our participation in the world is generosity, this beautiful circle of giving and receiving. It's like we see a response and we see it's beautiful because it's not coming out of greed, anger, and delusion. And so there's that simple appreciation, whether it's somebody else's response or our response, even somebody's response that might be unskillful, like they're being mean. But we see how it can't be other than it. We see the roots of it. We intuit the roots. When somebody does this, they're hurting. They're living out of a view that's very narrow, and that hurts. And I care about that. Doesn't mean that we don't engage, doesn't mean we don't say what needs to be said or do what needs to be done. But we're not confused by the interdependent and natural, impersonal unfolding of all things that we're part of, not separate from. How could we be a part of that? And this really changes our whole relationship with messes at work, at home, here in your community, clouds and water, in our water communities. Like I mentioned earlier, this is such a powerful dynamic in my practice, this dance between wanting to escape and understanding that I need the messiness, I need the responsibilities, I need this imperfect world, because this is where we express. So whatever intuition, whatever insight, awakening you've had, we need the world. We need exactly what we don't want to sort of purify and fully express that freedom. There's no real freedom without all of these petty tyrants, these difficult places. And when you get good at the difficult stuff, then you have to learn how to be free with the beautiful stuff. In some ways, it's even more challenging to bring awakening to the places where there's joy and where there's goodness and where there's beauty, so that there's no fear, no clinging, no trace. There's just the activity of love or the activity of freedom. So I need to finish now, but remember that this, the fruit of our practice, depends on moments, times of secluding. Ideally, you know, every day, twice a day, retreats from time to time, where we really, it's like refreshing the mind that non-attachment, equanimity, peace, and ease is actually available for this heart. And then, so let's just see, well, how about now as I go do my job, you know, when you're on sesshin and you got to go into the kitchen with a bunch of other people who have got all their stuff coming up from the practice, right? And we're all basket cases just looking to be triggered, right? And so where does freedom look and feel like there? So I hope these words you can use in a way in your practice, and that we can all take responsibility for making this world of ours wiser, more loving, and just somehow not believe the stories our minds have that are coming out of fear and coming out of hate, coming out of division, separation. Like maybe this world is exactly the way it needs to be for awakening, for a more beautiful expression of fearlessness and wisdom and love. So thank you for listening to the Dharma.